Hi, welcome to this week's program. Those of you who follow my show or my blog know that I love to help people by helping them become better educated about sound financial planning. But today I want to go beyond things like the basic principles of financial planning. Instead, I want to share with you six specific financial planning ideas that, if you put them to work, they may help you make your financial dreams a reality in record time. These six tips may supercharge your financial planning, help keep you focused on attaining your financial goals, and simplify your financial life all at the same time. Pretty good, huh? Well, first, let's integrate what's important into your life and put that into your financial planning. A lot of people fall down on the job of financial planning, the budgeting, saving, and investing part, because it looks and feels like more work than they want to do. And maybe budgeting and saving and sitting down doing that, that's just a little too boring. Also, they're not really invested in the process, only the outcome, and that makes the process harder. Want to make it easier and more important? Then find ways to connect your financial planning and achieving your financial goals to the things that really matter to you in your life. For example, if you're charitable and one of the charitable causes that you've chosen to support financially, let's say, is a local women's shelter, then maybe get personally involved by volunteering in some way at the shelter, and you'll find that budgeting money for charitable causes will be something you'll make time to figure out. And one sure benefit of doing something like that is that you get the chance to see what your donations are actually accomplishing. Finding a financial mentor is the second thing. Robert Kiyosaki, author of the well-known Rich Dad, Poor Dad book series, talks at length about the importance of surrounding yourself with and partnering with financially successful people. If you want to mirror Warren Buffett's success in stock market investing, then you need to find someone who can give you Buffett-like advice, rather than trying to pick stocks with the help of someone whose investing expertise doesn't extend past the fact that they own a few mutual fund shares or they day trade for a living. The fastest way to get good at doing something is by modeling someone who's already successfully done it. So, if you're looking to build wealth through investing or by starting your own business, seek to connect with people who have already successfully done those things. Network locally through the Chamber of Commerce and professional organizations or clubs, and online through sites such as LinkedIn. After you've developed some relationships and found someone you think is appropriate, before asking them outright if they'd be willing to be your financial mentor, just ask their advice on a thing or two. That way you can kind of test out how good a fit they might be for you. Ask your financial advisor if he or she can connect you with someone. Odds are they know someone who can be a good mentor for you. Important characteristics to look for in a financial mentor include being a good teacher. You know, if they have expertise but can't communicate it well, they won't be much help. And also being a good listener. It's important that they pay attention to what your personal financial goals are. Finding a good financial mentor is one of the things that may jump you from first gear to fourth gear in your financial planning in no time flat. Here's an easy one. Get a better savings account. We all need to regularly put money into savings in a liquid account, one that we can have access to our money quickly if need be. Finding ways to save is the whole purpose of budgeting, and saving is the foundation of investing, which is the key to help build financial security. However, we all know that regular bank savings accounts are not really an advantageous place to park your money because they don't really pay enough interest to cover inflation. How can you make the best of this bad situation of needing to keep money in a low interest account in order to keep money easily accessible? Go the extra mile and find the best bad savings account you can. As of 2019, there are numerous banks offering savings accounts that have no minimum deposit or balance requirements and pay over 2% interest. Now, I know, 2% will never make you a millionaire, but it's still more than twice the interest that most banks are currently offering on a regular passbook savings account. Taking your money out of A and putting it into B, which will pay you more than double of what A was paying you, is never a bad idea. Search for other high-interest accounts online as well. Online is a great place to start. Hey, maybe you can become a bank. A savings account is where you keep your emergency fund of 6 to 9 months' worth of living expenses. I think we all know that. It's also where you keep money for things such as medical emergencies, unexpected vehicle repairs, or dealing with a family of beavers who moved into your living room during a recent flood. You keep that money in a readily accessible account precisely because you might need it on an emergency basis. But you're not likely to need all of your emergency fund money at once, and so you can probably safely keep part of your savings in a slightly less liquid account. Why would you want to do that? So you can earn a much better return on investment than the interest your bank pays on your savings account. Now, one of the smartest things you can consider is diverting part of your savings into being a bank yourself. Now, we all know the basic equation of how banks earn their money and why they have more money than we do. They get money from depositors to whom they pay a low rate of interest, and then they loan that money out at significantly higher rates of interest. Wow, wouldn't it be great to be a bank? Well, guess what? You can be. One of the financial innovations of the 21st century is what is known as peer-to-peer lending. Websites such as Prosper.com connect people wanting to borrow money with people willing to lend money. They pool the money deposited by investors, and you can start with a minimum investment of just $25, to provide loans to the borrowers. As a peer-to-peer lender, you may earn up to 8 to 12% interest. Now, you're not getting such a high return without taking on risk, and there is a higher risk of default by borrowers. But peer-to-peer, or P2P as it's referred to, those websites continue to strive to improve vetting of their borrowers. Also, you can specify the level of risk you're comfortable with. Even if you specify that your money only be loaned to the lowest risk borrowers, you may still make a higher return than what banks pay you to put your money into a savings account. Since this is a newer phenomenon, it has its own unique risks, such as platform insolvency risk, which means that the peer-to-peer lender goes out of business, technology risk, the higher risk of fraud. So of course, with any investment, make sure you do your homework before investing. Now here's a funny way, trick yourself into saving money. A lot of people find it difficult to get into the habit and stay in the habit of regularly saving money. Since saving money is the first and therefore crucial step in becoming financially secure and attaining your financial goals, this is an important problem to address. Well, here are a couple of tricks you can use to make yourself a better saver. Number one, reward yourself for saving. One of the reasons people have problems saving is that the reward for saving is down the road a bit time-wise. In other words, you don't see any immediate benefit from saving money. You don't get any instant positive feedback. Well, one savings trick you can use is to change that. Give yourself a reward for saving right away rather than 40 years from now when I retire. Try something like this. For every $100 you put into savings, give yourself $10 to spend on whatever you want. If you're putting $100 a week into savings, then you should at least give yourself one nice dinner out every month. Plus, it builds a positive connection in your mind to savings when you think about the fact that you're enjoying this nice dinner out as a reward for being a good saver. Instead of having the thought, saving money means I have less money to spend every month on stuff I want, you can implant the much more financially beneficial thought in your mind, saving money lets me treat myself to doing things I want to do while knowing at the same time that I'm taking care of my future. Here's another trick. Consider taking advantage of automated savings apps. Making savings automatic makes saving painless. It also makes you a more efficient saver. In other words, you will build up your savings more quickly. Take advantage of the opportunity to save more easily by using automated savings and investment apps on your phone, for example. Most of these programs are designed to help you automatically save and invest. These accounts, which can start with just $5, gives you access to over 100 stock and ETF investment choices, along with professional investing tips to help you pick your investments. You tell the app how much you want to invest. Again, it can be as little as $5 at a time, and how often you want to siphon money from whatever checking account you link the app to, and what you want to invest in. That's it. You're all set. These apps will then automatically transfer and invest money according to your instructions. Another popular savings and investing app rounds up every purchase you make with your linked debit card or credit card to the nearest dollar and puts the spare change into your investing account. It helps you save money in the same way as you saved all your spare change in a jar. The two key differences are that A, it's automatic and you don't have to think about doing it, and B, the money is immediately invested. These apps enable you to buy partial shares so that you can invest even the smallest amounts of money. Also, these apps help you select investments by asking you basic questions about your current financial situation and risk tolerance. Based on that information, the app then suggests appropriate investments for you to choose from. Here's another idea. Save money and make money at the same time by using consignment shops. You know, using consignment shops is a great way to both reduce your expenses and increase your income. First of all, you can dress for success a lot less expensively by shopping at consignment stores. You can find designer clothes and accessories for up to 80% off their original retail price. You may well be able to clothe yourself in designer fashions for less than what you'd pay to buy the store brands at major department stores. And don't worry about not being able to find anything other than old threadbare coats. Most consignment shops, particularly those that specialize in high-end designer threads, only take items that are in excellent condition and not more than a couple of years old. Now, the flip side of using consignment shops is that, in addition to using them to save money, you can use them to make money too. Just go through your closet periodically and pull out the things that you either haven't worn any time in the last year or you figure you're probably never going to wear again. Your consignment shop sale items might be fashions you're no longer crazy about or just things that don't fit anymore. A friend of mine who lost a lot of weight thanks to a dedicated diet and exercise program made enough money from selling on consignment all the clothes that she had that were too big for her new figure, to pay for most of the furniture in her new apartment. Now talk about a win-win. Selling on consignment, you usually more or less split the sales price with the store. In other words, you get about half of what the item sells for. Some consignment shops will pay you a flat amount up front, essentially buying the items from you. That upfront price is, of course, significantly less than if you made the standard consignment sale. But it's a guaranteed sale, whereas you might put things on consignment that take months to sell or even never sell at all. You can check out local consignment shops, which may include chain stores like Pandora's Closet. And there are also a number of successful online consignment shops such as ThredUp, Poshmark, and The RealReal. So these are several simple steps you can take to improve your financial planning and fast-track achieving your financial goals. So here's a quick recap. Make the things that are most important to you a tangible part of your financial planning. Get a financial mentor to help guide you in making your financial dreams a reality. Get a better savings account and then explore lending yourself. Consider using financial apps to automate or set your savings and investing and profit from both buying and selling at consignment shops. These are just a few of the tricks you can use to take your financial planning up a notch. Pick out at least one or two that you will think will work best for you in your current situation and then write it down, stick it up on a wall somewhere, or put it in the Reminders app on your phone to show up every day. And don't procrastinate. Remember the sage words of Larry the Cable Guy. Just get her done. Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomeranz Show, and I'm Steve Pomeranz. Jeff Baskies is a longtime and well-respected attorney in Boca Raton. He concentrates his practice in the areas of estate planning with wealthy families, entrepreneurs, and athletes and celebrities. He's a graduate of Trinity College and Harvard Law. He's licensed to practice in Florida and Massachusetts. He also contributes to the Steve Lineberg Asset Protection Planning newsletter, where I found some interesting articles that he was writing. And I've asked him to join me. We've actually been friends for quite a while, and I'm so happy to have you in the studio.
Thanks for having me, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
So why have I invited you? What is this topic all about? It's kind of a serious topic, but it's kind of a fun topic too. And it has to do with our homestead exemption. Sounds boring, I know. But if you own a house in Florida, you're aware of the homestead exemption because it's got some basic benefits. And the other thing that's interesting about that article was the case involves Scottie Pippen, who is the former NBA All-Star. He played 17 seasons in the league. He's a 6-time world champion, a former Dream Team member, and a 2-time Olympic champion. So if everybody remembers Scottie Pippen, and he's, you know, we know that Scottie's used to winning. But I guess in this case that we're going to talk about, he's having some difficulties because he bought a house in Fort Lauderdale for, well, I don't know how much, but he tried to start selling it at $16 million. But something has happened, and I'd like you to take it forward from there.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I don't think what's happened had an impact on the property value, to be fair. But yeah. My understanding is that the price has been dropped below $10 million at this point. Mm-hmm. So he's definitely not winning in the real estate market in Fort Lauderdale. The case involves Scottie renting the house, however, after Hurricane Irma to a married couple who were displaced as a result of their house being damaged and apparently agreed to pay him $30,000 a month to rent the mansion in Fort Lauderdale while Scottie continued to market it for sale. Mm-hmm. As a result of their moving into the property, there was a lease that was entered into that required them to maintain the property in what was called pristine condition. So it's not your typical rental where it perhaps said you just have to keep it in broom clean condition or something of that. There was obviously a very specific intention by Scottie Pippen that the house had to be kept cleaner than average to the highest level of cleanliness because he was still showing
the property. Yeah, he wanted to still show the property. And I think this lease was for 7 months or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. And they needed 7 months because their house was being repaired. They got insurance money, apparently, for the damage from the hurricane, and then they intended to move back. So at the end of the term, it turns out that apparently they completely trashed his place.
Okay.
Which is what
Which
is what led to the lawsuit. I said apparently.
Yeah, okay, apparently.
So Scottie Pippen finds his house in less than pristine condition. How's that?
Yeah.
And files a lawsuit alleging in excess of $100,000 in damage done to his home because of many things, but probably most importantly, he claimed that they allowed their dogs to urinate and defecate on the property, which destroyed much of the furniture that had to be replaced.
Okay, so we got the facts, but why do we care about this? And one of the reasons has to do with the fact that Scottie may have been living on the property and it may have been his primary residence. But because he started renting it out, something changed. And also, I think he moved as well.
Correct. So one of the primary benefits of owning a homestead in Florida is that you get a benefit for ad valorem tax purposes. We have a reduction in the value by approximately $50,000, sometimes more for widows and whatnot. But approximately $50,000 reduction in the taxable base. And perhaps more importantly, there's an annual 3% increase cap, meaning that the value of your property can't go up by more than 3% for purposes of the tax assessment to the local communities.
Yeah. So even if the house value goes up 10%, the tax cost won't go up more than 3%.
Exactly. And that's very important for people, especially if you've had their homes for a long time and they've appreciated in value.
Yeah.
If you do not have a homestead exemption, it's not that the increases are unlimited, but it can go up by as much as 10% per year.
All right.
So again, cumulatively, the difference between a 3% cap and a 10% cap can mean a lot of money in taxes.
Now, also in the state of Florida, your home or your homestead has certain high level of asset protection from creditors, right?
Absolutely. So perhaps the most famous protection that homestead property offers to the residents of Florida is that as long as you're on less than half an acre if you're within a city or 160 acres if you're outside of a municipality, as long as your property is on less than the acreage, the property is exempt from the claims of your creditors, regardless of its value. Mm-hmm. So for example, if you're on a third of an acre in the city of Boca Raton and your property is worth $25 million, the entire value of the property is exempt from creditors, which is very, very unique.
Yeah.
Very few states, in fact, have that level of exemption. And many states have restrictions of as little as $250,000 of value or less.
Okay. Now, we don't know whether Scottie Pippen was using it for that particular purpose, but we do have another story to tell of someone who actually was trying to avoid liability as a debtor. Someone was coming after him and he did move to Florida. We'll get to that in a minute. Mm-hmm. So Scottie Pippen sues this couple. It becomes public knowledge. And I guess the price of being famous is that it gets published. The media picks it up immediately because he's a celebrity. And now we're talking about it, right? So
that's great for us.
There's good parts to being a celebrity, and there's some downside as well, and this is one of them.
So the downside for Scottie Pippen is that as soon as he no longer resided in the Homestead property and he rented it out to these tenants, he was no longer eligible to claim it as his Homestead property for tax purposes.
But he did. Yeah.
Now, the way it works, so everybody understands, is that basically you apply for the Homestead exemption when you move into the property, which I assume he did because he had the exemption. And as long as you reside there, you essentially are automatically renewed every year.
Mm-hmm.
So the property appraiser will send those little postcards that you get in the mail just to say you've been renewed. If for some reason you're not entitled to be renewed, let us know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that Scottie had to affirmatively do something every year to say he was eligible. So it's possible he simply just forgot or didn't pay attention. But he was continuing to claim the benefits of the homestead exemption, even though once he had moved out and rented the property, he wasn't entitled to them. Because of his celebrity, because this lawsuit became public, the property appraiser for Broward County, where this property was located, investigated and decided that Scottie Pippen, in fact, was not eligible.
Well, as soon as you're renting it out, I think you're automatically ineligible.
That's correct. As soon as you rent it out, you're supposed to voluntarily.
So that's an important lesson here.
Very important lesson. If you rent your homestead property, you're no longer entitled to the ad valorem tax benefits.
Mm-hmm.
You are, in fact, obligated to tell the property appraiser you're no longer eligible. Of course, we don't know how many people, in fact, do that. In this case, for example, Scottie Pippen did not.
Hey, I have a question. So let's say I have a property and I have a guest house in the back and I rent out the guest house. Does that prevent me from claiming the homestead exemption?
Actually, it doesn't. So long as you continue to reside in the primary residence,
right.
If you rented out a room above the garage, you shouldn't lose your homestead exemption.
All right. Well, that's good to know.
But if you rent out the primary residence, you would.
Okay. So I guess the lawsuit's ongoing. We haven't really heard anything about it. It's $100,000. Now, Scottie Pippen was notified that he no longer had the homestead exemption, so he had to pay penalties. Now, what are the penalties if, in fact, I've claimed an exemption that I'm not entitled to?
The penalties are really threefold. First, the property appraiser will assess you for the amount of tax you should have paid if you didn't wrongfully claim the exemption. So basically, you have to pay the amount you would have paid if you didn't have the homestead exemption.
Okay, fair enough.
In addition, you have to pay a 50% penalty.
Mm.
So if the amount you should have paid was $10,000 more than what you did pay, you not only owe the $10,000, but you owe another
$5,000. Mm-hmm.
And then there's interest that accrues at 15% per year.
Pretty steep.
Very steep. Yeah. Now, in Scottie Pippen's case, he was lucky. Maybe this is a benefit of celebrity.
Yeah.
The year in which he rented it and it became public is the year in which the property appraiser went and investigated. Now imagine if Scottie Pippen lost his entitlement 1 year, but continued to claim it for 10 years.
Yeah.
So now he would owe the differential in taxes, not for 1 year, but for 10, plus a 50% penalty, plus 15% interest per year.
One of the objects that Scottie Pippen accused the renters of losing or destroying was some Cuisinart knives, right?
Absolutely. That's what it says in the lawsuit.
That's what it says. We're only repeating what we read here. And so I guess as a little dig back to Scottie Pippen, this couple actually started a GoFundMe page for $14 in order to get the money, to raise the money to pay Scottie Pippen back for the Cuisinart knife set.
And from what I understand, based on my Google search, it looks like they've actually raised about $30.
Oh.
So they may get him two knife sets,
Steve.
Oh,
that's good. You know, I want to change from Scottie Pippen because there's another case here that I thought was really fun to read. And it has to do with the games that people play with this homestead exemption. So in this case, there was a doctor from California. And as I mentioned earlier, due to a liability that he incurred because of an accident that he was involved in, and I guess he wanted to avoid paying, he moved to Florida and bought a $1.5 million condo in Palm Beach. And then he claimed that his interest on the property was exempt from this judgment against him because it was his primary property and he was living here.
Yes, my understanding is he actually bought the property in Florida while the lawsuit was still pending before the judgment was entered. He ultimately lost the lawsuit. A judgment was entered against him. And in the efforts to try to collect on the judgment, the plaintiffs found out that there was an allegation that $1.5 million was now exempt from their claims because he had purchased a Florida homestead.
Right.
So they investigated independently to see if, in fact, he was residing in Florida and thus eligible for the protection because, of course, Florida homestead protections are only afforded to Florida residents. So if you're not literally residing in Florida, you don't get the benefits either of the ad valorem tax benefit we're speaking about with Scottie Pippen or the creditor protection from this case. And interestingly, in their discovery, they found out that the doctor was spending most of his time outside of Florida in a unique way.
Yeah.
Do you know what they found?
Yeah. No, I'd like you to tell us.
So they checked on his gym records, and it turns out that he went to the gym like 300 days out of 365 in the year before the lawsuit.
Yeah.
And they determined that, in fact, it wouldn't have been possible for him to do so if he wasn't in California.
Well, I tell you, I never thought much of our tax collectors, and especially our homestead tax collectors, but I got to tell you, they're really on the dime here. I mean, this is like a CSI case. I mean, going to the guy's gym records, for goodness sake, really?
Well, to be fair, the forensic work in that case was performed by a plaintiff who was looking to get a large judgment, so it was worth their time.
So they had a motivation.
Exactly. Now, the property appraisers, and this is an important lesson to take away, the property appraisers do look for what they would call homestead tax fraud or ad valorem tax fraud. And for example, the property appraisers in Florida frequently are known to speak with the Department of Revenue in states like New York, where the state of New York Department of Revenue is looking for people who really owe income taxes up in New York, and they communicate with the property appraisers in Florida, and they actually share information, and sometimes it leads to an audit of an income tax return in the state of New York, or conversely, sometimes it leads to loss of homestead exemption in Florida.
And they can kind of see your driving patterns because, like, we have SunPass down here, they have something up in New York, and they can really click and see how much you've actually been up there.
That's correct. Their forensics are pretty significant.
Oh, boy.
So they will look at things like your SunPass or the equivalent up north. They will look at things like your utility bills. So, for example, if you claim that you're in Florida in the summer, but your electric bill is only $40, they know you weren't here, right?
Okay, yeah. So don't mess with a man. That's what I'm going to
say. Don't mess with a man. Yeah. Let's be straight with our taxes.
All right. My guest, Jeff Baskies, a well-respected attorney in Boca Raton and concentrating on areas of estate planning. Thank you for joining me, Jeff.
It's my pleasure. And we hope more people come to Florida and, in fact, reside here and take advantage of the homestead exemption.
To hear this in any interview again, if you have a question about what we've just discussed, a homestead exemption question, I'll actually send it over to Jeff. But don't forget to visit our website, stevepomerantz.com, to join the conversation. And also don't forget to sign up for our weekly update to hear about all of our upcoming live events and important topics that we covered straight into your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
I noticed some information on Florida Realtors' biggest legislative victories. Wow, that sounds really impressive, doesn't it? And one of the remedies was to open, what has to do with open and expired permits. And when I said that, you practically jumped out of your seat.
That's a double yay.
So, what's making you so mad about permits?
Okay, so here's the deal. The word open is a four-letter word. And as realtors, this kills us. First of all, to understand what this all means, when you go to sell your home, they run a tax lien, a city search, open permit search, and they undiscover these permits that have been sitting around since, I've got three of them this week from like 2004, 2005, 2008 different properties.
People open a permit, but they never close
it. So your air conditioner guy opens a permit, the hot water heater guy, the electric guy. So there's all these permits that are laying around open that you don't know about. Now, here's the thing. You don't learn about this until like 2 weeks before closing when the title company runs their search. They don't want to run the search right in the beginning when you say you have a deal because, A, it costs money. So there's a fee involved to just run the permits. So now you find out a week before closing you have an open permit. This is a monumental task to get closed.
Yeah.
You have to, if the contractor still is in business, most of them are not,
that's a very good point.
So you're hunting down somebody from 2005, especially with roofs. We had a hurricane back in 2005. Wilma.
Mm-hmm.
And they almost like gave us carte blanche, just get your roof, whatever repairs you had to do. So there was like no permits going on.
Yeah.
Well, that wouldn't even really be a problem. The problem here is when somebody opened a permit but never closed it. So now the homeowner has to run to the city, reopen a permit that's expired because it's now an expired open permit, pay fees.
To catch it up.
Well, right. Catch they'll up. Charge an open fee. I just had one done for $220. Mm-hmm. Then you have to get the city back out there to inspect it. Now, they're inspecting a roof from 2005. Mm-hmm. Do you think whatever was wrong 2005, they're even going to be able to pick up on? Yeah. It's almost like time for a new
it's
roof.
It's a joke, yeah.
So it really delays our closings. If somebody is insistent on it being closed out, I just had this today, as a matter of fact, the buyer insisted that it be closed out. They wouldn't close. Well, guess what? This was a three-way domino. If this first one didn't close, the second wasn't going to close, the third one, wow. and the fourth one.
Yeah.
Over, I forget what it was, a silly permit. So the seller spent triple fees and then hired a closeout fast permit guy.
Specialist. There is such
a
thing?
Correct. They get paid a lot of money to deal
with this. Wow, I want to do that. Listen, anybody out there is looking for a job,
that
sounds like
a
great job.
It really is. Yeah. So this is really good news. I don't know exactly all the details. It takes effect October 1st, 2019. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically what it's saying is going to allow local governments to close a permit 6 years after its issuance, as long as there is no apparent safety hazard issues.
So they come out, they say you didn't repair a sinkhole and the ground is bowing again or something.
Right, right.
So no safety issues, obviously. So they'll just close it
out. But most of these are just silly open permits that are just hanging around.
Okay. So, you know, the thing is, I think there's some confusion. I know there was on my part about what you need to get permits for.
Oh, boy.
Because there's actually an article where this woman said, I wasn't able to close on my house because I didn't have a permit. I disclosed later that I had replaced the toilet. And I'm thinking, why do you need a permit to replace the toilet? It's inside the house. You were saying that faucets.
I mean, technically, almost everything in your house needs a permit. If you're going to go by the letter of the law. And so that brings up another subject that goes to seller's disclosures. So on the seller's disclosure, there's a question. Did you do any work without a permit, or did any previous owners do any work without a permit? I would say, obviously, you can't be responsible for what other people did. So I would answer that as I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would even say I don't know as an owner almost. Because you may not realize that that faucet that you changed out 10 years ago, oh, by the way, it's now you maybe changed the third faucet out with a permit, but not the first faucet out with a permit.
Oh, God.
I mean, where do you draw the line to this?
Well, first of all, it's insane that if I replace a faucet that I need to get a permit.
I'd get a plumber. I don't know. I'd want you to change it out, Steve.
That's true. That is true. Actually, if I was changing it out, I would definitely need a permit.
And a plumber.
And an inspection when I was done, no question. But that's the point. So if you replace your water heater,
right,
which is something you can buy in any big box or other store.
Right. I wouldn't install it yourself. You would need a plumber.
But the plumber has to go and create and open a permit.
Technically, which of course, then you can go without hot water for a while waiting for your your permit to be issued.
Well, I think the big deal here is that a lot of people don't know what requires a permit.
Right.
You may answer on this form, is there anything outstanding? And you go, no, because you honestly think so. And then they find out later that actually
is an issue. Right.
And that could cause problems. And I think the big lesson here is that by the time they have to do a search for open permits, it's very, very late.
It's at the end. It's like a week, 10 days before closing. And that's where we were running into all these issues.
All right, I want to change topics here because there is some confusion as to what is a deposit that you're being asked to put down and what is a fee. So, you know, when you see the words non-refundable deposit, what is that? Let's talk that word through a little bit, those two words. So a deposit is something that you put down. Let's say you have a pet.
Right.
And the owner of the property wants to protect against any damage the pet does. So it asks you for a deposit. And then once you leave, if there is damage, then they can use money from the deposit.
Right.
Okay, that's one way a deposit is used. If the homeowner is saying to you, I'm going to charge you an amount to have a dog, that's a fee. But it's not a non-refundable deposit because that's an oxymoron.
It is an oxymoron. And it is hysterical because we talk in refundable deposit terms, and non-refundable deposits. And a non-refundable deposit, no matter how you name it, is a fee.
Yeah.
But no, who wants to say, I'm going to charge you a fee for your pet? Right, right. Doesn't sound right.
So it's a use of words that actually obscures intent.
Correct.
And I'm not a lawyer, but I just sounded like one.
It sounded pretty good.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
The issue, the real issue, though, is you should not accept the terminology non-refundable deposit. You should say to the person, that's a fee, isn't
it? That's a fee.
Pet fee. Okay.
Pay the fee.
Well, we're out of time. I guess, as always, this is Terry Story, 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomeranz Show. I'm sure you've read about the recent SAT scandals, the one in which parents were caught bribing officials and paying test takers to game the system. Now, perhaps it's a foregone conclusion that if so much energy and resources are concentrated around the outcome of tests, like the SAT and the ACT, corruption would inevitably occur. This story, however, is not about the SAT. It's about how we're coercing our children toward the relentless pursuit of success at very tender ages. To further understand this problem, I've invited Forbes publisher Rich Karlgaard to talk about his new book, Late Bloomers: The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. In this book, Rich offers us an incisive critique of a culture that has caved to the pressure to produce prodigies. Rich is also a late bloomer, like myself, I might add. Rich, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
So you had a mediocre academic career, and after graduating, you worked as a dishwasher, a night watchman, a typing temp, before finally finding your inner motivation. You're now a pilot, a lecturer, author of 4 books, and publisher of Forbes, which I mentioned earlier. So how did your own background as a self-proclaimed late bloomer ignite your research?
Well, I was a late bloomer, and I grew up in North Dakota. I was a B student in high school. I went to my local junior college. I raised my grades to a B+, basically A's in the easy courses, B's in the hard courses, and then a truly hard course like organic chemistry, I'd drop after the first practice test. Mm-hmm. But through a combination of factors that would never repeat again, I was able to transfer to Stanford. I was a runner. I was a pretty good runner, but not a scholarship level runner. You know, from being from North Dakota, being the kind of runner who could fill out a squad, I was able to get into the university. If anybody's feeling jealous about that, let me reassure you, justice prevailed because I barely got through. I didn't know what I was doing at all. Mm. I took easy classes with names like Sleep and Dreams and Human Sex, and even those were too hard, and I would retreat into the library. I mean, how do you screw up Human Sex?
Yeah, I know, exactly.
And I would retreat into the library and read old issues of Sports Illustrated, and no graduate school wanted me. I didn't even know what I wanted to do. And so in my mid-20s, I had the jobs you described while my roommates were off doing fabulous things, beginning great legal careers, working on the space shuttle program. And I was a security guard who discovered one night, you know, when I was making my rounds and I heard a dog barking, that I had a colleague, a professional colleague, was a Rottweiler.
Yeah.
And he was probably provided more bang for the buck. He was a better deal than I was as a security guard.
Yeah, I know that had to be a low moment for you.
I did feel ashamed of it. I mean, it sounds comical now. But a few months later, Steve Jobs, also 25, would take Apple public. And it was on the temp typing assignment, maybe 18 months after that low point happened, that I was at a research institute in Palo Alto, and they had a dressing room and shower facility. So some people would run at noon, and there were some good paths, and I started running. And some of the scientists and engineers said, "Rich, why are you in the temp typing pool?" And I actually got kind of tearful, and I said, "I don't know." I said, "I just haven't found what I wanted to do at all." And they gave me a chance at being a technical writer and technical editor. And it was the first time in my adult life that I actually leaned into the job. Mm-hmm. And more than that, working with scientists and engineers opened up a whole territory of my brain that had been, I didn't even know was there, sort of the logical process side. And then I began to bloom. I was very conscious of the fact that a new day had dawned. I mean, it seemed like a dramatic thing to me to be taking on an adult job, dressing appropriately as an adult, and learning to think like engineers and scientists.
You know, I think that story is probably the story of millions of us around the world, really, all finding our niches when it's time to, you know, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear, that kind of thing. I know for myself that I was very misdirected. I had a troubled childhood, and it took me a long time to kind of get out of myself and to try a lot of different things. I sprayed lawns for an insecticide company. I short order cooked. I was a musician for a while until I got married and had a child and realized that that wasn't going to support my family, and eventually got into the investment business and learned from the ground up there. And then, you know, as the years progressed, learned my craft. So I know that's a common story. So why do you think our culture has this misguided obsession with early achievement?
I think it has to do somewhat or quite a bit with the economy. The only sure bets in the U.S. economy over the last 20 years have been in cutting-edge technology, Silicon Valley kinds of technology, and in high finance, investment banks, hedge funds, things like that. You know, other industries have been lucrative, like real estate and oil and gas, but they've been a little more boom and bust in nature. And when you look at Silicon Valley and when you look at Wall Street, you see two clubs. And these are clubs where the door is open to people who went to Harvard Business School, Stanford Engineering School, MIT, a few schools like that. And it's a harder door to open if you're coming from, you know, a state school in the Midwest or maybe one of the lower middle-ranked colleges in the U.S. from anywhere. And people kind of get the message. They get the message, parents get the message that, my gosh, as we hurtle into this technology-driven, artificial intelligence-driven future, to give my kid the best chance, maybe they have to get into that club.
Yeah.
And so we've erected this conveyor belt designed to take people into that club. Wealthy parents in New York are spending $50,000 for their three-year-olds at a pre-K schools now. And the pre-K schools talk about a multi-building campus, exposure to different languages,
All
of this kind of stuff. But what they're really saying, if you read the literature, they're saying, hey, if you want to maximize your kid's chances of getting to Harvard 15 years later, you better start now, right here.
I'm sure they're saying that my three-year-old's got to learn Chinese.
Yeah, probably. And then they've got to learn how to code AI algorithms when they're six or something. And well, look, some people respond to that. They really do.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a parent and your kids are responding to that, then God bless you. You know, you're fortunate and keep it up. But if your kid starts to exhibit signs of anxiety and depression or is saying scary things on social media, then plan B shouldn't be to double down on plan A.
Yeah. You know, I follow Warren Buffett a lot, and he, you know, he says that he had a particular set of skills that were ideal for his chosen profession and interest. And had he been born in a different country or a different period of time, he may have been an abject failure. I mean, he says if sports or athletic abilities were important, he would have been a failure and other things, I'm sure. So his particular set of talents fit with his particular field. And I think what you're saying is that a lot of these children who excel in these narrow programs that are able to get into these institutions like Stanford and Harvard, it's a small percentage of people, but they have those kind of innate talents. The rest of us don't.
Yeah. And so consequently, this conveyor belt reveals their strengths, and it doesn't reveal the strengths of the majority of people. In fact, what it does is it strips them bare and shows their weaknesses. So, I mean, look what we do in the United States. We're so quick to apply the ADHD diagnosis to some kid who can't sit still. And I just was reading a few weeks ago that the person who first came up with the ADHD concept, I'm forgetting his name, but he's now greatly distressed that this has been way over applied. Well, not only do that, that 95% of the Ritalin prescriptions in the world are written in the United States. We've almost turned the youthful inability to sit still and focus, just in other words, you turn normal kids into some, you know, clinical problem. Mm-hmm. And that's a disaster. So the kid who can't pay attention because their real skills, let's say, are in, they have spatial skills that make them really great carpenters or artists or sculptors, things like that, rather than their strengths being revealed, only their weaknesses are revealed, and they go out into the world feeling like second-class citizens. And their parents, you know, are now wondering whether they did them a disservice.
Right.
So that's I think, the big flaw out there. By the way, Warren Buffett, I'm sure he would fall right into line with all these 800 math SAT scores that create companies like Microsoft and Amazon, et cetera. But when I read Warren Buffett's biography, I think it was a setback that was the greatest gift to him. It was a setback when Benjamin Graham told him, no, you can't join my firm. You know, I, a Jewish man, Benjamin Graham, need to reserve, spots for Jews because at the time, you know, Wall Street was pretty anti-Semitic and doors were closed. And so Warren went back to Omaha and built his own firm and stayed really close to Ben Graham, of course. Ben Graham, out of love, did him the best thing that he could have done.
Well, he also got rebuffed from Harvard. Because that, I think he went.
That's right.
Right. So that was another important.
And he went Columbia Business School.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. Otherwise, he wouldn't have met Ben Graham and so on.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. Interesting. My guest is Rich Karlgaard. His book is Late Bloomers: The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. You know, you write that this relentless pursuit of achievement at an early age works against some of our human characteristics for those who don't fit, you know, so narrowly into that space. It works against curiosity and discovery and other factors that are missed out in this drive for science, technology, engineering, and math. Can you take us a little further in that?
Yeah, it does. And I think pushing people onto the STEM track, first of all, I think everybody should have fluency with science and technology. But a STEM track for everybody as a notion might be overdone in the same way that the SAT is a weapon of meritocracy against the entrenched aristocracy was a good idea, but it was overdone. Mm-hmm. Because any job that is rules-based is in danger of being wiped out by AI. And sometimes the most creative, eclectic backgrounds will produce the best results. Somebody in your field, since you know the investment field well, Ken Fisher, Fisher Investments, $100 billion under management.
Yeah, I've interviewed him.
Yeah. And he's a quirky character.
Yeah.
And Ken struggled to get his financial advisory service going throughout his 20s. He had to supplement his income with construction jobs. He played steel guitar in a bar band and not some foo-foo bar band. It was a Harley Rider bar band or a Harley Rider bar.
Uh-huh.
But along the way, as he said, he read all kinds of investment books. I'm sure he read The Intelligent Investor.
Well, his dad
and he read all kinds of trade. Yeah, his dad, but his dad was a legendary thinker. But as Ken said, his dad would have been diagnosed with Asperger's, and his dad, he said, he tried working for his dad, and it didn't work out at all. And his dad had a hard time keeping people. And so Ken launched Fisher Investments without help from his dad, and in fact, he didn't even have his dad particularly as a role model. Ken wanted to be a forester before he went into what he has become known for.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, back to his 20s, even when he was appearing to struggle, he was learning in his own creative way because he was reading all these investment books and then, as he said, about 30 trade magazines a week. And as he likes to say, I developed some unconventional ways of how to value companies.
Yeah. Who are some of the other notables that have been late bloomers?
Well, there are the famous ones in our culture that I decided not to write about because you could have read about them before the book, people like Colonel Sanders and Ray Kroc and so on. But one of my favorites is one of my personal heroes. He died about a dozen years ago, but I got to know him quite well, Bill Walsh, the football coach,
okay,
who won three Super Bowls for the 49ers back in the day. At age 36, he was finally got his first head coaching job, and it was the dregs of organized football. It was a semi-pro team called the San Jose Apaches. They played it on a junior college field. They practiced on a lumpy high school field. He's 36 years old. The year before, he'd been running back coach for the Oakland Raiders, and so he was going downhill in his 30s.
Mm-hmm.
But it was there, while watching a high school basketball practice after his own practice, where he saw the team practicing inbounding the ball against the full-court press, that it suddenly occurred to him, what if he designed a football offense like that, with a lot of pick and rolls and short passes? And then he got a chance to apply that at the Cincinnati Bengals when he was offensive coordinator, and then, of course, to a celebrated level when he had a point guard. Basically, Joe Montana was a great high school basketball player, had been offered a full ride at North Carolina State under Jim Valvano. People forget that about Montana, because the rap on Montana is that he didn't have a quote-unquote NFL arm coming out of Notre Dame.
Uh-huh.
But Walsh saw exactly what he needed, the guy with peripheral vision, the point guard.
Yeah. So you had Frank McCourt, who wrote his first book at age 63, Angela's Ashes, which was a wonderful book. He won a Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah, and more recently, Daniel J. Brown, The Boys in the Boat.
I don't know that.
Which is on the New York Times.
Yeah.
Oh, that's about that was on the New York Times bestseller list for about 2 years straight, maybe in 2015, 2016. That was a story about the Depression-era kids who made up the University of Washington 8-man crew team.
Wow.
They were poor, desperate kids, and they had an unconventional coach. And first, they beat the aristocratic schools in the East Coast, and then they went on as a unit to win the gold medal in the 1936 Olympics, beating Germany under Hitler's nose. And he published that book at age 62 after being a technical writer at Microsoft.
Mm. J.K. Rowling, too.
Yeah, J.K. Rowling. Not as old as Frank McCourt or Dan Brown, but she was a single mother on public assistance in her early 30s. When on a train, she got the idea for Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm. So I know there are many more. We're not going to sit here and list, you know, too many, but the idea is that there is a natural way that human beings develop. Certain things happen at certain ages. Executive function in our brains, you know, things happen when we're 25 years or younger to us that we're just are not available to our brains, or our brains are not mature enough, you know, to develop until we're in our 40s and 50s. Can you take us through some of the timeline of brain development?
Yeah, there are two studies that I want to cite that are really hopeful. One was a study that came out in 2015 led by a Harvard researcher named Laura Germine. She was doing postdoc work at Massachusetts General Hospital with another postdoc, Josh Hartshorn of MIT. And they asked the question, at what age do we cognitively peak? And the answer is far more complex than they had anticipated. The answer is, it depends what kind of cognitive ability you're talking about. So rapid cognitive processing speed and working memory, the things that make you a really good software programmer, do peak in our teens and 20s. And it gives some people in Silicon Valley this idea that we peak as people in our teens and 20s because it's such a narrow view of human potential. But then a whole set of skills that you name. Well, first of all, our prefrontal cortex in our brain, on average, isn't fully done developing until 25. And it could be older for many. I'm sure it was older for me. And then we began in 30s, 40s, and 50s to develop a whole set of cognitive attributes, deeper pattern recognition, facial recognition, higher emotional IQ, equanimity, mm-hmm. which is the ability to stay calm under pressure. All of these things, leadership skills, begin to really blossom in our 30s, 40s, and 50s. And then in our 60s and 70s, we begin to acquire all these cognitive abilities that support this ancient notion of wisdom. And here I lead you to the second scientist. He's a little bit more of a maverick. His name is Elkanah Goldberg of NYU. And he started noticing in his late 60s that his intuition was producing answers to questions that then when he would back test it, using a logical process, the intuition would stand up under the test of logic. What on earth was happening? How was I able to arrive at these logical answers by the path of intuition and get there much faster? And so he has a theory. Again, he's a maverick in the industry. He seems to rile some people up, but that the two hemispheres of the brain keep developing these networks, which he collectively calls the salience network, throughout our healthy lives. And that's what he thinks wisdom is. It's basically the logical side and the intuitive side developing more and more pathways. So you might perceive something novel on one side of your brain, and then that novel perception goes to the side of stored memory and logic, and you have a better idea of what that new thing that you just saw or perceived is really worth. And so our creative yield, as opposed to our raw creativity, actually gets better as we age, simply because we know what to do with the creativity we've just perceived.
Yeah. Well, I think we kind of all know that as we get older. I mean, I notice certain things about myself, things I'm able to understand, and connections from different parts of my life and different parts of other people's life as an advisor, that I can see the kind of the larger picture and put them together in creative ways. I see that now. I don't think I had that when I was in my 20s and 30s, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I will make a confession to your listeners. What I like to do on airplanes rather than watch movies is I'm a voracious consumer of thriller novels. And I just love thriller novels. And all the great spy novelists and thriller novelists, they're later blooming. They first break on the scene generally, you know, in their 40s, and then they end up doing their best work in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. And I just finished Neon Prey by John Sanford. You know, John Sanford is in his mid-70s, and he's really bringing it. Or you look at Lee Child, who created the Jack Reacher series. You know, Lee Child is in his mid-60s, and you look at the Reacher books today versus when they started out, they're far richer.
Yeah.
Far richer, even approaching literature today.
Interesting. You know, we're out of time. It's gone by very fast. There's a lot here I wanted to talk about what needs to be changed in our education system so we're not stifling these late bloomers, but we don't have the time. So anybody who's interested in this topic should go to the book, get the book, which is Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement, and also come to our website. You can hear this episode again if you go to stevepomerantz.com. And also while you're there, sign up for our weekly update for upcoming live events and important topics like this one that we've covered this week straight into your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com. Rich Carlgaard, thank you so much for spending your time with me.
It's a delight to be with you, Steve.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform, and of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show was obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.